Good evening and welcome to the Asian American and Asian Research Institute's Friday Lecture Series. I'm Anthony Wong, Program Coordinator of the Institute. Thank you very much for joining us for tonight's presentation on Ginkgo Okazaki, a Japanese-American novelist in the age of ultra-nationalism by Alan K. Ulta and Andrew Leong. Based on their current research, the beginnings of which we featured last year in our academic journal, CUNY Forum, Volume 10. Joining us from LA is Russell Leong, founding editor of CUNY Forum, to say a few words about the journal and the origins of this presentation we have tonight.
Welcome. This is really an international endeavor, fittingly. I know we have people from all over the world. When Alan reached out to me with the soil salinas and also telling me a little bit about Okazaki Ginkgo, I realized that actually she was really a part of the trajectory of Japanese-American writers, from whether it's Haruo Yoneda, John Okada, Milton Moriyama, Isayama Yamamoto, Toshio Mori, and many more who were working class, or I guess you could consider them to a certain extent proletarian writers, who wrote about Japanese-Americans and Japanese, the Issei, the Nisei, the Kibei. And, you know, it's really fitting, and we are really honored to have had a chance to publish this small excerpt, which will be available free, I think, courtesy of CUNY Forum. One note that people may not know, that especially Japanese American literature is actually being studied and taught in places like Poland and Germany, and people might wonder why. Partly for four reasons, because many of the writers, including Okazaki, deal with themes of migration, minority-majority relations, war, and nationalism. So it's really fitting that, especially now, and we'll hear from Alan and Andrew in a few minutes, how everything kind of coincides at this moment. So thank you, Alan, Andrew, Stephen, and everyone for actually joining us from around the world.
Alan K. Ulta is a writer based in Washington, D.C. area. He has been a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Alan has covered Congress as a senior writer for CQ Roll Call and an editor at large for LexisNexis Law 360. He was a Tokyo correspondent for the Oregonian and the co-founder of the Asian American Journalists Association's Asia chapter. Andrew Wei Leong is an assistant professor of English at the University of California, Berkeley. He also serves as the scholar editor for Issei Poetry Project at the Japanese American Cultural and Community Center of Los Angeles. Professor Leong is the translator of Lament in the Sky by Kaya Press, a collection of two novellas by Los Angeles-based writer Nagahara Shoson. Please welcome Alan Ulta and Andrew Leong.
Thank you very much. Anthony, appreciate the introduction, and I'd like to start by, if you would just imagine that you're an aspiring writer or an artist, or maybe you're just a consumer of the arts, and you're still processing the fact that the United States has elected an ultranationalist leader, President-elect Donald Trump. Well, you might be thinking about doing some traveling. But better yet, you might be thinking about creating or reading some novels that address your deep concern about the future of immigrants and their children and of individual rights in a country led by an autocrat. It might be useful for you to hear the story of a Japanese-American immigrant novelist named Ginkgo Okazaki, and to read her novels, because she dealt with these issues in another age of ultranationalism. It was in the 1920s and 1930s. Hopefully, you'll get to read them soon as part of a planned academic book project led by Andrew. In times like these, perhaps novelists and other artists can play important roles as chroniclers, translators, and defenders of liberty and morality. And that's the sort of role that was played starting in the 1920s by novelist Masue Shinozaki Orimo, whose pen name was Ginkgo Okazaki. I hope you have a lot of questions today about Ginkgo and our topic, a novelist in an age of ultranationalism. I know we have members of the family and friends of the Ginkgo Okazaki Project taking part. They include journalists and novelists, artists, and others working on the front lines and dealing with ultranationalism. We also have scholars. I see Chris Kevany from Japan in the participation list and others. And we've appreciated support from the curators of the Densho website, Japanese American National Museum, and the Library of Congress. As an immigrant, Ginkgo was caught between two empires. And that's a phrase that comes from historian Eiichiro Azuma. In her case, she was caught between authoritarian nationalism in Japan and a kind of anti-immigrant populist nationalism in the U.S. I first got to know Ginkgo Okazaki as the mother of my aunt in Berkeley, California. We met a few months before Ginkgo passed away at the age of 78 in 1973. And after Ginkgo died, I lived with two roommates in her little house in Berkeley. And I learned she had written novels in Japanese, which had never been translated into English. While I was struggling and trying to write poems and short stories, banging them out on a manual typewriter as a college student, I used to wonder what she wrote about, what she thought about while living in this dark brown two-bedroom house filled with books written in Japanese and English. And there was a lemon tree out front, and out back there was a little garage that had been her late husband's art studio. I began thinking about Ginkgo's writing and its relevance in the present day on January 6, 2021. At the time, I was working as a news reporter in the halls of Congress. I witnessed the mob attack on the U.S. Capitol. And I was struck by how that rampage resembled similar events in Tokyo in the 1930s. They were described in an unpublished English translation of Ginkgo's novel Soil of Salinas, and the translation was done in the 1990s by Stephen Cole, a University of Oregon emeritus professor. Ginkgo wrote about how ultranationalists in Japan seized government buildings and attacked and assassinated military and political leaders. This was in Japan in the 30s. Her novel described how these events in Japan had affected Japanese American communities, creating deep divisions. A recurring theme in Ginkgo's work was her commitment to Christian socialist values, and she used a personal GPS. It was her moral code to analyze political and social dynamics in real time. That personal GPS helped Ginkgo decide what issues to write about and how and when to write about them. It also helped her to decide what risks to take as an artist and as a truth teller. In a time of ultranationalism, it's not uncommon for writers and artists, even journalists, to become targets as enemies of those in power. Writing or talking about certain subjects could get someone fired or put in jail. In Ginkgo's case, she was summoned to an all-day interrogation by the Japanese military police, the Thought Police, after she'd been heard criticizing the war to neighbors and coworkers while she was living in wartime Tokyo. These days, Asian American novelists and other artists must deal with ultranationalism in the U.S. and in Asia. And if they are immigrants, they may be scrutinized or threatened by agents or people with ties to foreign governments. There's been reports of such people with ties to China and to India conducting overseas surveillance and even trying to silence dissident voices in the US and Canada. And Ginkgo dealt with similar issues during her time in California and in Japan. But before we talk about her novels, let me tell you more about her as a writer. She was born in 1895 into a family of teachers and doctors north of Tokyo. You cannot overstate how rebellious Ginkgo was for a young college student and a beginning teacher in Japan around 1915 to 1920. Women, they weren't expected to work, and their marriages were arranged. She graduated from Japan's First National University for Women around 1916, and on the screen you can see a picture of her standing on the right, wearing her university uniform, standing with members of her family in Saitama around 1915. So her first marriage was arranged, and it ended in divorce. She married for love the second time in 1920, choosing a California-based communist labor organizer and teacher, Kichitaro Orimo. He was 10 years older. While her husband returned to work in California, she stayed in Tokyo, gave birth to their daughter, and continued working for several years as a teacher in a fine arts high school for girls in Tokyo and as a fiction writer after hours. She chose a pen name, Ginkgo. It's an unusual name. It was used by men and women of the time, both men and women in Japan. She hoped editors and publishers and readers might be more willing to embrace her novels if they thought they were written by a man. She found a mentor in Masao Kume. He's a well-known playwright, and here's a picture of Kume with his close friend, Ryunosuke Akutagawa, and other writers at a literary conference in Osaka in 1920. There must have been some women at this conference somewhere, but they're not in this picture. Maybe you've, okay, here's another picture of Kume. He was prosperous, screenwriter as well as a playwright. Maybe you've seen the 1950 film Rashomon, who was based on a 1922 short story by Akutagawa. Like Akutagawa and Kume, Ginkgo wanted to escape the old conventions of feudal Japan by experimenting with new ways of telling stories and exploring new topics such as gender issues and the struggles of workers and artists. The Great Tokyo Earthquake of 1923 changed many things. It devastated the economy. It triggered purges of critics of the government, socialists, labor organizers, and others. And it led to censorship laws and made it dangerous for a novelist, a socialist, and a feminist like Ginkgo to remain and to work in Japan. As you can see on this passport document, she and her 2-year-old daughter emigrated to the U.S., arriving in Seattle on June 27, 1924, and that was just 3 days before a sweeping U.S. ban on Asian immigration took effect. Despite such obstacles, this was a fertile period for Ginkgo as a novelist. She gave birth to a son, Kazuo, and by day, she and her husband worked as teachers in Japanese language schools in Monterey and in Delano, in California, and she moonlighted by writing several serial novels for Japanese language newspapers in California. About those teaching jobs in the Japanese language schools, it meant that Ginkgo and her husband were really in the middle of a controversy over what should be taught in these Japanese language schools. Some American politicians called them un-American. The state of California required Japanese language school teachers to be licensed, and they had to teach their students to become American citizens. But factions of Issei parents fought over what they wanted their children to be taught in these schools. Many wanted Japanese-style education to instill filial piety. After going through these experiences in the 30s, she began working on a pair of link novels, and The Bell of Salinas and Soil of Salinas, and they focused on the political forces that were swirling around Japanese American families as they decided whether to continue living under these harsh conditions in the U.S. or go back to Japan. Here is the namesake bell. It weighed many tons, and the arrival had been cast in Japan, and the arrival in Salinas was a big event, as you can see, and it was installed at the Buddhist church. They say that that bell, when it rang, you could hear it all across the fields of lettuce and the other crops in Salinas, and the workers could hear that thing ringing from many miles away. In 1938, the Bell of Salinas won honorable mention in a national fiction contest for Kaizo, a popular magazine in Japan. Here's a picture of Ginko and her family around 1940, just before she and her teenage son, Kazuo, went to Japan for an extended visit to her ailing mother. And after arriving in Japan, Ginko received a tantalizing letter from the progressive publisher of Kaizo, Sanehiko Yamamoto. And in that letter, he offered to publish the two Salinas novels and to pay her not less than 3,000 yen as a deposit or an advance on future royalties. But he warned her that publication likely would mean her imprisonment for up to 2 years for violating a censorship law that banned criticism of the national essence. She turned down his offer and put away her manuscripts. After the Pearl Harbor attack, she and her son were stuck in Japan. And she worked as a school teacher throughout the war. A U.S. bombing raid a month before the end of the war destroyed her home in Chiba and the manuscripts of both Salinas novels. Her husband, Kichitaro, spent the war in a Justice Department detention center in New Mexico. After the war ended, he went to join Ginko in Japan. When Ginko and her husband returned to the U.S., it was 1952. She found an old outline of Soil of Salinas, and she began rewriting it in her little brown house in Berkeley. In 1966, Soil of Salinas appeared as a serial novel in a Japanese language newspaper in San Francisco and as a self-published book in Japan. And here is a picture of Ginko with her daughter Taya around that time with Edward Reischauer, the ambassador to Japan and Harvard professor, and he's standing with his wife here. In Soil of Salinas, we can hear the voice of a mature writer who conceptualized that book and this whole idea of people caught between two empires. She conceptualized that when she was in her late 30s and 40s. It was before the war. And then she completed the book in her 60s with the wisdom of time and the benefit of long reflection after the war. As I mentioned, Andrew Leong has been trying to pull together translations of Ginko's novels, including earlier works that were written soon after she first arrived in the U.S., when she was new to the U.S. and the U.S. was new to her, and she was really blending things, things that she had learned to Japan, things she had learned in Japan with things that she was learning in this new country, in the new land. I cannot wait to read the translations of her earlier works when she was just starting out here. I think Andrew's book, the proposed book, could be a useful guidepost for writers and artists and readers living through another age of ultranationalism in the 2020s. Thank you.
So as Alan mentioned, I started to become interested in working with Alan on a further translation of Okazaki Ginko's works, building off of the initial translations done by Professor Stephen Cole, who's in the audience today, of the Soil of Salinas. So I'm going to walk through some of the context for reading and translating as part of this project through one of the newspaper serialized novels that Alan mentioned. So Okazaki Ginko's Cypress Sighs, or Cypress wa Nageku, published in 1927. If you have follow-up questions, please feel free to ask at the email address listed below. In case there's no time for Q&A today. Okay. So as mentioned, there were two novellas that were serialized in the Shinsekai, or the New World, a newspaper that in the 1920s was published in San Francisco, but also had branch offices in Sacramento and Los Angeles. So Cypress Sighs was the first of these, published in 20 installments between January 4th and 23rd in 1927. And then later the next year, Okazaki Ginko published under her given name, not the pen name, Orimo Masue, in a longer novella, 63 installments from June 25th to August 30th of 1928. So a few things to talk about in terms of context for understanding what newspaper serialization looked like and what kinds of literary community Okazaki was entering as she came to the United States in 1927 and began her the American phase of her literary career. So the Shinsekai is one of the oldest, or was one of the oldest, Japanese newspapers in San Francisco. It was initially published as the Shinsekai in 1894 to 1932 by activists in the San Francisco Japanese YMCA, although it later dropped its affiliation with the Christian Church. Some scholars point out the rivalry between the Shinsekai and another newspaper run by the editor Apika Kyutaro, called the Nichibei Shimbun, or the Japanese American Daily. That rivalry centered on questions of religion and ideology, with the Shinsekai being less assimilationist and more aligned with Buddhist segments of the community, and arguably in some context a little bit more left of center than the Nichibei Shimbun. Although this isn't like a categorical division, there are differences and nuances that I don't want to create the impression that there's like a polarized right-left split between the two newspapers in every instance. So one kind of thematic that Alan and I were talking about and reflecting upon is this question of how to deal with questions of repetition. And as we look at repetition of historical events or lessons that we had hoped to have learned in earlier periods, but seem to recur over and over again, this line from Walt Whitman, which in the context of the Song of Exposition is an optimistic one, now takes on a slightly more pessimistic tone. How little the new world, after all, how much the old world. So some key thematic contexts and questions for trying to understand the significance of Okazaki Ginko's work in general, and in particular, what is at stake in recovering her serialized newspaper literature, is to really dwell on how literature has both timeless and timely qualities, that it speaks across historical periods, but also provides us a kind of image of the period to which it belonged. And this is especially the case for newspaper literature, or literature that's printed alongside the news and in conversation with all of the current event issues that are going along in its own time. And part of the work of translation of newspaper literature is to try to convey those contexts in ways that allow the literature to shine and reflect and illuminate the conditions of our shared and ongoing present. So as Alan mentioned, some key contexts to think about are that Ginko was writing immediately after the immediately after the 1924 Immigration Act, which was an exclusion based upon national origins, which functionally excluded Japanese nationals from emigrating to the United States. Some other contexts to think about are it's not just hostile or nationalist racist immigration laws in the U.S. that we need to consider, but also ultra-nationalist or increasingly conservative crackdowns within Japan itself. So Alan mentioned how after the Kanto quake in 1923, there were increased persecutions of leftists and others, and the passage of something called the Peace Preservation Law in 1925. These all provide a kind of set of political contexts for the pressures that Ginko was addressing and responding to in her serialized literature. So one key context and question that emerges in her writing is reflection on the Issei as at least a double generation, and in some ways a triple generation of pre-1907 and post-1907 immigrants. So the period of the Issei, or the first generation, is a kind of double or triple length generation, at least in terms of immigrant generation, because the Japanese nationals could come to the United States from the period of 1885 to around 1924 and 1925, and that allowed multiple familial generations to be present in the United States in the same time. So that could be like father and mother, or father and sons and daughters. And so the Issei, even though we think of them as one immigrant generation, could in fact be multiple generations within one family. But this includes a kind of problem where there's fraught transitions from a predominantly male or bachelor society, where immigration restrictions for unmarried women in the pre-1907 period, and then a kind of demographic shift as more women emigrated into Japan as part of arranged marriages or picture marriages or proxy marriages, led to a kind of shift from a more bachelor, migrant laborer, or student-oriented society in the earlier Issei cohorts to plans towards mixed generation agrarian family settlement, or the creation of merchant businesses, or other forms of a social organization. Ginko, as a Christian socialist and a proletarian writer, was conscious about navigating questions about land, labor, and inheritance, but also cautious because she was participating, she was concerned about family members both in Japan and in the United States, about what she was publishing and in what context, and aware of different kinds of censorship regimes both in Japan and the United States. So some things that she talks about in the public-facing newspaper literature and initial works allude to questions about land and labor, but don't necessarily do so in explicitly Marxist, anarchist, or socialist terms. Whereas the Soil Salinas, which was published in the 1960s, is a little bit more free about some of the depictions of the ultranationalist versus leftist or labor union organizing that we'll see later on. Another key thing to be aware of is that because this is Japanese language literature, and some of the works that Ginko is writing feature yobiyose issei, that is, issei that are the children of issei that had previously settled in the United States. So what we might now call like a 1.5 generation issei, as well as kibe nisei and jun nisei, are in Okazaki's novels and short stories, all speaking mostly in Japanese. So the kind of understanding of the Nisei, or what would later become the Sansei, shifting into English, or there being a language gap, is not really a phenomenon that appears in Okazaki Ginko's novels, which can give us some insights about different kinds of social organization or closely knit agrarian communities, as in Salinas. Okay, a key point here is that newspaper literature is always surrounded by context, literally with other texts. So in this image here, the Cypress wa Nageku short story appears on page 2 in the kind of left-hand column, but you can see how it's surrounded by all sorts of other information. On the top of the page, there's an allusion to a royal visit of one of the members of the imperial family to California. There are other kinds of articles about imagining the future 30 years from now, are classified ads. There are advertisements for banks, for remittances, for steamship kinds of travel and things like that. So I think that it might be helpful to understand how Okazaki's work is, of course, separable from its context. We can publish and translate it independently and have its aesthetic value speak to us, but it can also enhance our understanding to really understand why and how Okazaki was intervening or thinking through the thematic questions that were present in her works. So as a kind of illustration of some of the things that are going on in the newspaper literature context are in the post-1924 period, there's extreme, intense concern about the future of Japanese American community with the impossibility of further emigration to the United States. So there's an entire genre of New Year's literature in the 1920s about imagining futures for America. In the context of the page just over from Okazaki Ginkgo's story, there's an article, How I Imagine Compatriots in America 20 Years Later. There's literary submissions from children. So some of perhaps Okazaki's students might have contributed material to the children's column down below here that provide kind of a venue for nisei or second generation children to practice their Japanese and display it for their parents. And then perhaps most importantly, within the context of a newspaper, in the dead center of the page, and in many instances directly in the middle of Okazaki Ginkgo's short story, Cypress Size, are advertisements for study tours, 3-month tours running from February to May, sponsored by the Shinsekai company to have second generation men and women and their parents gain exposure to Japanese culture firsthand through study trips abroad to the homeland or to the Japanese homeland. So all of these can help us provide a picture of how the world of the short stories and novellas that Okazaki was publishing were informed by all of these kinds of concerns about language, about the future of Japanese America, and relationships between Issei and Nisei, or older Issei and younger Yobiyose Issei. This we can find through the cast of characters that I've mapped out in Cypress Size. So the protagonist of the story is a young man named Yuichi, who it's not quite specified, but seems to be either a Yobiyose Issei or a Nisei, who is dealing with the legacy of a prior generation of Issei, who had set up a kind of family agricultural business. So Ryuichi's father was in a triangular relationship or a kind of a business relationship with a person named Ito, a person with the surname Tashima. And there's a kind of conflict about the inheritance or distribution of that business because of some nefarious dealings, perhaps by Tashima, the bookkeeper of Ito and Ryuichi's father's business. There's a love interest, a bright and intelligent young woman named Eiko, as well as in the context of the Salinas settlement, an extended and tightly knit community of grandmothers, aunts, reverend, and other figures within the Salinas settlement that can help us contextualize and understand the intense, in some cases melodramatic, although realistic depiction of an inheritance or succession struggle. And all the problems that are attended upon imagining transfers of wealth or land from a first generation to a second generation under periods of extreme anti-Asian and anti-Japanese sentiment around these issues in California. We can see Okazaki's work, I think, especially in its linear setting, is anticipating the later writings of more famous white American writers like John Steinbeck and, say, the Domestic Migration and the Grapes of Wrath, or Cannery Row, or a similar kind of fraught succession story in the Salinas area east of Eden, there are some kind of reminiscent formal characteristics about familial and land and labor struggles going on across these works for us to consider. As one kind of final contextual note, I note that we're an international audience, and so it might be helpful to show maps of where these kinds of locations are. So Salinas, the kind of setting of many Okazaki Ginko's texts, is inland from the coastal areas of the Monterey Bay. Cypress Size takes place or has a climactic scene at Cypress Point, which is at the very tip of this area by Monterey and Cromwell by the Sea. One of the great historical ironies is that this beautiful scene, which takes place at the far stretch of land pointing into the Pacific, was within 1 year of the publication of Cypress Size turned into a fancy private golf course near the Pebble Beach area. So the landscape is forever different from what it would have been in the context of the climactic and intense final scene at Cypress Size, which I won't spoil now. We'll wait for the translation work to proceed, but I think can provide us a kind of image of the different landscapes and worlds we're thinking about Okazaki Ginko's work. So now we'll transition to some audio readings from Stephen Cole's translation of The Soil of Salinas, a book that was drafted in the 1930s, but had to be rewritten after the manuscript was destroyed and was republished. And I have a kind of copy here for show and tell. I'll provide the introduction while Anthony and Alan provide these. So these short audio excerpts are read by Sophie Oda, who is an actress and Ginko's great-granddaughter. You can check out Sophie Oda's work on Instagram and can find audiobooks read by her on Audible. So the first excerpt takes place in the searing hot summer of 1934 in rural Central California. In the first sentence, the narrator describes the ultranationalist concept of the Japanese spirit, or Yamato Damashi, as this intangible thing. Is it a fog or a virus? It comes across the Pacific to Japanese American communities on the West Coast. The narrator captures the predicament of living between two empires. In Japan, ultranationalists are spreading the idea that they are destined to rule over parts of Asia. In the US, African Americans, Latinos, and Asians are being scapegoated for economic problems during the Great Depression and are targeted with discriminatory laws by an unwelcome California legislature and the US Congress.
As Japan began to expand its national power into Manchuria and China, the intangible thing called the Japanese spirit crossed the Pacific and began to powerfully penetrate the Japanese community here. With the passing years, this influence increased, and the crest of this wave was reached in the early summer of 1934, when an ultra-nationalist fencing master named Akamatsu came to America and gradually promoted a militarist mood. The Japanese who hosted Akamatsu were mostly people ranging in age from their 30s to their 50s. People just in the prime of their life. This was 10 years after the anti-Japanese immigration laws were enacted. Most of these Japanese had established families, and a second generation of Japanese Americans had been born and were growing to maturity in America. While they struggled with many difficulties and handicaps, the 50 years of pioneering history of the previous generation was beginning to bear fruit. Taking the immigration to Hawaii as the first era, and the time up until the anti-immigration laws went into effect as the second period, we were now in the third stage of our history. By fits and starts, some of the second generation began to acquire citizenship, and, moved by their parents' remarkable passion for education, they were attending elementary, middle, and high school. In this way, the Japanese Americans demonstrated their commitment to excellence and achievement. At the same time, anti-Japanese sentiment was growing stronger by the day. And beginning with the Anti-Japanese Land Exclusion Act, passed by the state legislature in 1913, the anti-Japanese immigration laws, the anti-miscegenation laws, which forbid marriage between Caucasians and Asians, year by year, a variety of discriminatory laws threatened to suck down the Japanese community like a giant whirlpool. From the beginning, opportunities for action by the Japanese had been limited, and now they were becoming even more restricted. Ambitious activists and politically minded people, after many long years of effort, had nothing to show by way of success, but continued to act despite their frustration. There were two routes open to them. They could return to Japan, or they could continue to be active within the limited scope open to them.
The second excerpt features Ginko presenting her Buddhist protagonist, an immigrant farmer named Goro Murase, and his wife Shizuko on a farm in Salinas. They're trying to decide whether to stay in the U.S., living under harsh conditions with their children, or go back to Japan. In a Japanese community association meeting, we hear Murase being subtly criticized by his antagonist, Bunzo Uehara, a successful ultranationalist businessman who's made his fortune in the U.S. and is headed back to a glorious future in Japan. Uehara ridicules Murase for sending his children to American schools, including a son, Joji, who has broken California's law banning racial intermarriage. Later, we hear Murase and his wife talking in their bedroom about what Uehara said.
When old man Ebihara judged that most everyone had eaten his fill, he slowly rose to his feet. As soon as he began speaking, he had everyone laughing. And taking advantage of that, he quickly called on Mr. Kinugawa to continue the entertainment. Everyone knew that Kinugawa had a beautiful voice, but also that he did not like to sing in public. Reluctantly, he got to his feet, and saying he believed this was Mr. Uehara's favorite song, began a beautiful rendition of Yamakawa Somoku. He sang exquisitely. The old MC went on to call on one person after another to perform, carefully including those who liked to sing, but were not very good at it. This might have gone on all night until the old man called time. Meanwhile, the audience heckled the other performers with catcalls, "Oh, God save us!" or, "Ooh, that's good!" At this, everyone nearly died laughing. The old man was a great MC, and the program went on for over 2 hours. At the end, he called on Kinya Tashiro, who was about the same age as Hasebe. He was the leading organizer of the evening's events, and so was the natural one to conclude the activities. He performed superbly. After that, Uehara began to speak once again, expressing at great length his thanks and talking about his memories of the old days and what it meant to be leaving, and pointed out that so far there had been no racial difficulties around Salinas. Somehow, he never got around to saying just why he had decided to return to Japan. The first point he brought up had to do with the education of his own 5 children. He said that for a long time he had not been satisfied with the education he saw taking place in America. He did not mention any specific details, but from that point on his speech became impassioned, and bit by bit he began to digress until, in the end, it appeared that he totally forgot what was appropriate at a function like this. American schools and families focus on freedom, freedom, only freedom. They have become self-indulgent and willful. Americans have no appreciation for filial piety or sincerity. Everything is focused on the self, on individualism. With regard to these values we cherish, the only place they are instilled as a part of regular education is in Japan. Japan provides a splendid education founded on the ethical principles of filial piety and sincerity. Japan is the only country in the world where this is the case. Uehara appeared intoxicated by his own words as he began to praise Japan. Fortunately, thanks to the support I have received from all of you, I have the resources to provide a Japanese education for my 5 children. Sometimes he would squeeze in a few words of boasting or of thanks, then return to his main theme. It is important that children receive a true education from the earliest age. I don't have time tonight to enumerate the ways in which America's non-interventionist education poisons our youth. Among the most blatant examples of this is the fact that some of them even defy the laws of their own country. And so on and on, he went tediously saying the same thing over and over in different ways. Although he named no names, it gradually became clear to everyone who the victim of his tirade was. Up to this point, the meeting hall had been a lively, cheerful place, but now people lowered their eyes, and it looked like the gathering was a wake or a funeral. Whether people were listening to him or not, Uehara's diatribe became increasingly digressive. Probably he had in mind visions of the vibrant rising sun of the Japanese Empire, and of his own children striding heroically across the landscape. As might be expected, even the skilled veteran Ebihara seemed unable to stem the torrent of this monologue. Gozo Murase kept his gaze fixed straight ahead, and showed no sign of being upset, his face maintaining a completely neutral expression. His mouth was firmly closed, his arms folded across his chest, and his eyes focused on the distance. Beside him, his wife Shizuko sat pale-faced, her head bowed, rigid as a statue, both hands tightly clutching a handkerchief in her lap. When old Ebihara found an opportunity, he intervened to announce that the evening's program was over. People let out their breaths and looked up in sudden relief. They all waited until the Uehara family had left, then dispersed. By this time it was already after 11 o'clock. At the Murase home, Toshio, who had stayed home to keep an eye on things, was ready to jump in bed by the time the rest of the family returned. Even the normally reticent Yamada was obviously upset. Before going to his room, he said, "That was a complete farce tonight. For us younger people, this sort of farewell party for someone who has succeeded doesn't mean a thing. You two go on to bed now and have a good sleep. Just forget what he said and don't fret about a thing. I wonder what makes people talk that way." For a few moments before going to bed, the Murases exchanged a few quiet words with each other. "You certainly maintained your composure tonight?" Gozo was silent for a while as he drew on his cigarette, but before it was half smoked, he stubbed it out viciously in the ashtray. "I just sat there and let him whip me. He really went too far when he started talking about people who defy the law. Well, there's nothing we can do about it. The truth is that our Joji did violate California's marriage law," Gozo said, and crawled into his bed, looking across at Shizuko, looking depressed in her bed on the other side of the lampstand. He continued, "You worry too much about things. What does that guy really know about American education? He's never in his life attended a public school PTA meeting. He's never even visited a public school. Even in his business, he only deals with Japanese. He only employs Mexicans or coloreds, so what right does he have to attack American education?" The autumn weather remained beautiful for the next few days. Shizuko was extremely provoked one morning when, shortly after breakfast, her husband grumbled, "Maybe this would be a good time for us to go back to Japan, too. At least 8 bigwigs have already pulled up and gone back just this year alone." Both Toshio and Yamada had already left the house. "Do you still want to go back to Japan?" There was a sting in these sharp words from the normally soft-spoken Shizuko. "No, not really." This time she did not detect any disgruntled note in her husband's words. Judging from the mood in Japan these days, people like us who are residents of America are looked down on and regarded as outsiders. It's a matter of patriotism. Even Yoneo talks about it sometimes in his letters. Japanese are so narrow-minded that way. They can invade Manchuria all they want in the name of protecting it, but they'll never be able to catch up with the rest of the world that way. Because she was angry, Shizuko suddenly showered her husband with this sharp response, but it occurred to her that ever since the scandal with Joji, her husband had been emotionally wounded, and that sore spot had been further inflamed by Uehara's harangue. "I'm sorry," she said. "I've been upset ever since the other night. Yoneo will be coming home soon. By then I expect the issue with Joji will be resolved. We can decide what to do then."
"Right. It's not that urgent,"
said Gozo as he hurried out to the fields.
"I'm anxious to hear what people have to say, and I know that people are listening from many different locations. I'd like to give a shout out to a brave artist, Migiwa Orimo, who is listening from Illinois, and she is I believe, a relative of Ginkgo's, and she's a kindred spirit. And she's one of those brave artists working on the front lines and dealing with subjects such as ultranationalism, and has done works of art dealing with the issue of deportation centers in the present. And I saw a very moving display of her work at the Women's Museum, in Women's Art Museum in D.C. And she's done some great work. And just say a shout out to her.
So we do have a question from our CUNY Forum editor, Russell DeYoung. Russell?
Yeah, thank you, everyone. I just had a question for either Andrew or Aunt Stephen. In your translation of Japanese writers and your observations of both male and female writers, do they have different stylistic or content approach that you can discern? And does that make for certain insights or certain obstacles? I'm just curious whether gender, especially in those times, made a big difference or not.
It's a fascinating question, Russell. One thing that I think we can draw from Alan's pointing out that Okazaki Dinko worked with Masao Kume is that there's a quality that appears in Okazaki's work that I think shows influence from friends in modern theater in Japan, or shingeki, or like new style theater. And so one characteristic of her writing is that she's pretty careful about distinguishing the kind of styles of speech and dialogue between male speech, female speech. So in the context of Cypress Size, and one translation challenge is not so much like a fundamental difference about men and women writers writing differently, but Okazaki's handling of the protagonist speech, the older generation of women and male speech, and then the young Nisei love interest speech are all in different registers. And it can be tricky to figure out ways of handling that without overdoing it in English, but that would be really strongly marked in that. In the original text. One characteristic that shows up is that Eiko, the love interest in Cypress Size, sometimes speaks with more ellipses or dot 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 sequences in what she's saying. That's distinguished maybe by like the older figures in the text speaking in something that looks a little bit more like dialect than the other speakers of younger age. So I think that Okazaki, you know, in choosing perhaps a gender neutral pen name, maybe wasn't aiming to like write like a woman or write like a man per se, but is really adept at handling the different speech genre nuances within the text. I saw a question from Yuri Yamamoto in the chat or the written Q&A. So this was that many years ago, I read an excerpt of Soil Salinas accompanied by English translation in an anthology of Japanese immigrants, Japanese Americans. I reread it in preparation for this presentation. Is it possible to read her novels in Japanese? As a Japanese immigrant myself, I feel that nuances get lost in translation, particularly, and would love to read it in the original language. Yeah, a fantastic question. Soil Salinas was self-published in the 1960s. There are copies that I found at used bookstores or other venues that if you wanted to get a physical copy, you can certainly do so. And then I have typed in, I don't have ready to hand links for all of the different serialized stories, but if you use the Hoji Shimbun digital database hosted by the Hoover Institute Library and Archives, you should be able to retrieve the original Japanese language text of texts like Cypress Size, The Sphinx, and possibly others as well.
Well, in terms of your current research, how much longer do you think you have before you're going to complete it? And how long did the translation actually take that process?
Maybe we can direct this question to Professor Cole, who has done a lot of the main translation of Soil of Salinas. I'm still working on the serialized newspaper stories, and it might take me the better part of a year to get it like in good enough shape to share without embarrassment.
Yeah, great. Professor Cole should be able to speak.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, Soil of Salinas took about 25 years to translate. I started it when Alan first presented it to me, and then got involved with a lot of other things and sort of let it be until luckily Alan came back and kept prodding me along. And so I kept working on it until we got it to the point where it is today. But it was a long process.
Yeah, Russell.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that just on a practical matter, I heard that the UCLA got 30 million from the founder of Unico for Japanese studies. And I think that, you know, I don't really have a connection with, say, Japanese studies at UCLA, but, you know, there might be and this is Japanese studies in the humanities, I believe. So that might be, well, a future source to maybe investigate. Anyway.
We have a question from Stan Yogi, our friend out in California,
Hi,
and who
Stan.
has spoken at our past lecture series before on his children's book. Do you know if Okazaki Genko was a member of any Issei writing groups?
I don't know of any particular ones, but she was I understand that they're the home where they lived, they had a living room that was sort of like a salon, and they would have visitors from Japan that would come and visit. In fact, I think that of course Chris Kaveny has written a book about Sanahiko Yamamoto. I would speculate that this progressive publisher, he did do a tour of the U.S., which was in around 1938, 1939, around the time that she won the literary award. from his magazine, and I think they probably crossed paths, and I wonder he may have sat in her dusty living room there in somewhere in near Delano. And of course Chris had taught at, now I believe is at Rikkyo, but a university in Japan, but I had taught at Linfield College in Oregon, and has done a great book on Sanehiko Yamamoto. But I think that she retained, and she wrote a lot of letters, and she was probably corresponding with these folks in Japan. And I think when she was living in Japan, probably in the 50s, that she would have visited with other writers. I don't know if she, I don't specifically have names of other proletarian or proletarian feminist writers that she associated with, but we do know that she was in touch with Sanehiko Yamamoto and with Kume. And I should point out that Antony is in Gotanda Fudomaya, which is not far from Meguro, where Sanehiko's house, the house, I believe the house that where he hosted, Chris would know better, but the house where he hosted Albert Einstein on a famous visit in 1922, when he was trying to bring fresh ideas into Japan. That house is located not far from where Antony is sitting.
If I may, Chris, I can't, thank you, Alan. I can't really respond to the specific question about the literary salon, but it is interesting to me to hear, to learn more about the connection with Kaizo and Yamamoto. And Yamamoto's, the letter that you mentioned is particularly interesting. I mean, we know that it was dangerous for writers in the 1930s in Japan to have certain views, and Kobayashi Takeuchi is an example of that, the writer of the Cannery Boat, who, ultimately met his death in under police custody because of what he wrote. So this was no empty, no empty threat in terms of the government. So that was that's interesting, that letter. Then she took that to heart and decided not to publish it at that time. I was wondering, so if I may, just a follow-up question, kind of related to what was mentioned as well by proletariat writers. Like Kumi Masao is not a proletariat writer, he's not associated with that school at all. It's interesting that he was, in fact, her mentor. And I was wondering too, what association she had with proletarian writers, both while she was in Japan in the 30s and later, perhaps after the war. I don't know if that's, it's a pretty big question. I'm just kind of curious as to her association with the proletarian movement, the writers associated with that movement.
And I think that some of that may have been through her husband, who was a communist labor organizer, and he was an early immigrant to the U.S. He was 10 years older, born in 1885, and came to the U.S. I guess he was probably a sophomore. He dropped out of Keio because his dad's brick factory went under, and they didn't have money, so he came. And so there actually is were some articles. And I believe it was in the Heimin, which was a communist newspaper, which was sort of a variation of a communist newspaper in Tokyo, which was, I believe, was shut down by the authorities. And then I guess there was correspondence with Sen Katayama, and Sen Katayama was talking about her future husband at that point, Kichitaro, who was a labor organizer working in Fresno for trying to organize farm workers at the time. But she may have had contact through him. And, as you know, there were some of these artists and intellectuals and, communist socialists and so on, there was an exodus from Japan as a result of things that Andrew was talking about with the priest preservation law and whatnot. And so she may, that's a good question. I don't know. Perhaps Andrew would have other thoughts.
Yeah, it was kind of alluding to where and when Oryumo might have highlighted, or her editors might have highlighted those connections. And so I'm just going to share a screen for those of you that read Japanese, and I'll do some spot translation here too. This is the June 24th issue of the Shinsekai from 1928. And here it advertises the Sphinx. So it's pointing out a way to continue from people that read Cypress Size or Cypress Wanageku and linking the pen name, so Okazaki Ginko, to Oremo Masue, real name. And in the marking for this, there's reference to Masao Kume as a teacher and her as a disciple in order to, I think, speak to a broad possible audience appeal. And so that, I think, is a different kind of orientation to publishing or the commercial nature of the shinsekai than something that might be more explicitly activist or reflecting in a historical sense. So Soil Salinas is particularly interesting and might be compared to texts by, like, say, Carl Yonetta's autobiography or Ayako Ishigaki's memoir as a more leftist-oriented. What those are autobiographies or fictionalized autobiographies, but in this case, there's a kind of a conversation with those other leftist writers that's interesting. I'd also say that if the Stan Yogi's question about coteries and connections is a really interesting one, because there are resemblances between Okazaki's work and other kind of Shingeki writers in California more broadly. This Cypress Size in particular seems to be reminiscent of another kind of family drama that I've translated before, Sariyuku Mono by Nagahara Hideaki. There's a recording of it, I think, on the Center for Japanese Studies YouTube page, if people are curious about this kind of 1927, 1928 period for thinking about agrarian family drama in Japanese language, Japanese American literature.
I have a question from Yuri Yamamoto. What about women activists like Hirasuke Rito?
Raicho? I'm not sure about direct connections there. Alan, you might be able to fill that in. I know that shortly after Oremo arrived in the United States. This is a period where Tamura Toshiko would have been in Vancouver, so the leftist feminist writer, and then writing in a pen name shortly afterwards in Los Angeles area in the later part of the 1920s and early 1930s. So, there might have been some overlap there to consider or think about. Alan, any insights from your findings?
No, I just know that she was active in, several churches, and I think she would have possibly interacted with other writers and activists in the in these churches. She went to a I believe it was a Methodist church there in Sycamore. Or I believe was it the Sycamore Church in Berkeley, and I guess in her later life she was working with up on campus at UC Berkeley as a, believe it or not, she was a cook for a Asian students club called, it was known as Euclid Hall. It was up on Euclid Avenue. I think you probably know Andrew.
Yeah, I'd also say that Yuri's question raises interesting questions too about the nature of her education in Japan, who she would have been in contact with, or who could have been feminist mentors for her there. So, we can certainly take that as a further research question to look into in more detail.
Great. We have a question from a CUNY student, Alvi Chowdhury. I read John Okada's Nono Boy earlier in September and understand that it wasn't very popular when it came out, but grew in popularity after his death and has now become a staple of Japanese American history and Asian American studies. How does Genko Okazaki's works contribute to our understanding of the experiences of Issei and Nisei writers during the 20th century? And how do these works illuminate the broader landscape of Asian American literature and intersection with issues of race, gender, and immigration?
Okay, so some of the latter questions are maybe more broad than I can take a comprehensive stab at right now, but let's say, okay, so the allusion to John Okada's Nono Boy, its increased use in classrooms as and in Asian American literature more broadly, maybe has two big phases to think about. So one phase is the combined Asian American Resources Project and work by, I mean, Russell could answer this question better than I can, maybe in some ways, but that kind of collective that was interested in recovering and redistributing through University of Washington, the Nono Boy. I'd also point to more recent work by editors like Frank Abe and Floyd Chung, who have worked with historians and other writers to issue a biographical study of John Okada, the life of John Okada. And Floyd and Frank have also put together a Penguin anthology called The Literature of Japanese American Incarceration, which includes translations from me and a bunch of other folks that try to help flesh out different aspects that weren't really available in English translation until somewhat recently. Okay, then that's the kind of review of the history of Japanese American history and Asian American studies, at least in respect to Nono Boy. How do Okazaki Ginko's works contribute to our understanding of the experience of Issei and Nisei writers during the early 20th century and illustrate intersections with race, gender, and immigration? These are all really questions that I hope that our translation project can help a broader audience of readers, students, and scholars access and think about. I think without answering many of these things in advance, I think it helps to point out how to put this. What I hope and what I think I take away from Alan's presentation too is that Okazaki really was kind of fearless about pointing out divisions within Japanese American community and doing so through the vehicle of literature. And at a moment where thinking about divisions within not just Japanese American but Asian American communities, right-left splits politically within our own chosen or born communities are things that I think that Okazaki's works really can speak to. What the appeals of nationalism are for marginalized groups or people who feel like their inheritances or what they've been promised hasn't fallen through. All of those are things that that Okazaki's works really speak to in a powerful way, and I think can help illuminate for English language readers these kinds of concerns. Alan?
Well, I loved Nono Boy when I read it, and certainly I think it provided an understanding of a certain faction of Japanese Americans and how they lived through and responded to the internment. I think what sort of Salinas does is it sheds light on how another group of Japanese Americans sort of responded, not so much to the internment, but to the things that were happening in the U.S. and in Japan just before the internment. And these were the people that went back to Japan, and we call them in some cases, the kibei. They were children that were born in the U.S., sent back to Japan, where they had often difficult lives during the war, and eventually some of them straggled back to the U.S. And so she helps to elucidate that sort of what happened with that group. And I think that, there's a lot of talk these days about the resistance, and I don't want to get into a political discussion of what that consists of, but I think that the people that she was talking about in this Back to Japan movement or Go to Manchuria, in their own minds, they thought they were resisting racism and discrimination in the U.S. And they were embracing, what they didn't realize is they were embracing ultranationalism instead of Japanese style ultranationalism. So they're jumping from the frying pan into the fire, so to speak.
Alan, but, you know, I think it's a difficult choice. And scholars like Yuji Ichioka have actually thought about, written about that kind of difficult choice of Japanese America, of Japanese here who had to make some choices about staying here or going back to Japan. And, you know, Yuji, by the way, also wrote about Sen Katayama, who another participant mentioned. I just wanted to say that besides translations, I think two writers who are maybe somewhat overlooked now, but, you know, Stan Yogi, of course, is very familiar with them, as well as, you know, other people are Wakako Yamauchi and Hisaya Yamamoto. And Wakako was born and raised in the Imperial Valley, and she actually wrote about, you know, she was writing in the later period about workers, both from Japan and also, you know, Japanese American Nisei. And Hisaya also, you know, had a somewhat different take, more urban, I believe. But she also talked about, you know, Hisaya was a very nuance in terms of gender, and she even had, you know, talked about things like transgender issues and so forth early on, and that would be like 40 years ago. And so I think that it's interesting to compare maybe writers like Okazaki with the Nisei writers like Wakako Yamauchi and Hisaya Yamamoto, and see this trajectory. My last point is that I think a lot of times, you know, unfortunately, we just tend to talk about Asian American writers or writers of color in terms of what they add to our history. But I think what the writers actually do is are able to talk about the interior life as well, especially the women writers, the interior life and how it deals, you know, in vis-a-vis external circumstances. So I think that really is part of the contribution of the of women writers. They actually deal a lot with the interior life, like Wakako Yamauchi in terms of husband and wife relationships, farm workers, and so forth, from a very unique perspective. So I urge the student from CUNY who's interested not just in General Kata, but to explore Yamauchi and Hisaya Yamamoto, and their books are still available at, in print.
So one more plug from that cohort, and one that is really important, I think, for thinking about a comparison between Okazaki is Momoko Yiko. So there's strong resemblances to between Soil of Silliness and a play like The Gold Watch, which also feature like this kind of town hall dialogue about kind of a more ultranational, a Japanese ultranationalist position, and a more loyal to the United States position to think about too. So I think the recording of a performance of Gold Watch is now available maybe through UCLA, and it's certainly worth a watch. And, you know, it seems like a really interesting intertext to think about the Nisei portrayal of a moment like that, and Okazaki's more Issei-oriented approach.
Great. We'll take one more question because we're at time. Thank you to all, anonymous attendee wrote that thank you for all the presenters' works and presentation. It is said that Ginkgo wrote a manuscript of Soil of Salinas during the 1930s and rewrote and published the book in 67. Would you please tell us what historical, political, and social changes you can trace in her manuscript, notes, and books? And how did her views on Japanese imperialism as well as American ultranationalism change?
I'm not sure I can address how the views changed. That's a good question. She, you know, whether she may have felt differently about it in the 30s versus the way she felt about it in the, with hindsight in the 1960s. I think that given her background, she, as a socialist, she was very, shall I say, critical of Japan's, well, militarism, I guess, the from the Russo-Japanese War to the Sino-Japanese Wars, invasion of Manchuria, et cetera. And did her views change when she was living in Japan during the war? I'm sure they must have changed somewhat, but it's hard to put your finger on it. I think that she made a decision in the 30s that she really wanted to focus on this topic that we're talking about, which is living through an age of ultranationalism and trying to deal with this predicament of living between two empires. She made a conscious decision to really focus on that through the decade of the 30s, which making that commitment is interesting to me. She realized that that was a thing. Actually, I should mention that I was very interested in this issue, the Back to Japan movement, because on my father's side of the story, my grandfather and some of my uncles, they made a disastrous move to Manchuria. They thought it was going to be a life filled with I don't know, riches, glory. It was things had not worked out well for them in California, and they went to Manchuria. So they were caught up in this, and I think that Genko saw this happening in the 30s, and I think she was perceptive enough to understand that this was fool's gold, that this was not what you wanted to do, not where you wanted to be at. I think her views on the war were probably along the lines of Carl Yoneda, that there was a balancing, a binary choice in World War II. You had to make a choice. Which side were you on? And I think after the war, she was really determined to reconstruct what happened in the 30s, that she was determined to put that book out.
So this is also a question about where Japanese American community or communities might be today, and it's a live and tricky one. So one set of clues for a maybe potential change in Okazaki's perspective is that she wrote prefatory material and a dedication to the soil of Salinas. So the dedication is to those Issei who have not lived to see this present world, as well as to the members of the 442nd who died in battle. And so one thing that might be tricky for younger readers in the present to square is that what is a socialist leftist doing celebrating a U.S. military unit? And part of that has to do with, as Ellen alluded to, like Carl Yoneda or other socialists who understood themselves to be as part of a popular front to defeat the more immediate and pressing enemy of German and Japanese fascism, collaborated with the U.S. government for things like translation, or supported units like the 442nd, whereas there are other folks like the so-called no-nos or renunciants or draft resistors who understood their positions politically, not necessarily in terms of ultranationalism, but in terms of, say, principled resistance to some forms of unconstitutional and unjust incarceration in different circumstances. So, these kinds of very harsh, intense splits during wartime still have lasting damage in Japanese American communities and families today, even 70 to 80 years later. And who knows where the traumas of our current present are going to ramify for generations to come as well. the power of literature, I guess, from what Russell is saying, is to help us reflect on those past moments so that we can again attend to the concerns of our present.
Thank you to Alan and Andrew for your presentation and allowing us to feature Soil of Salinas, excerpts of it in CUNY 4, Volume 10. Once again, for those of you who attended late or were on the phone as a participant, we'll send out the PDF to you by email over the weekend. Thank you to Sophie Oda for reading the excerpts for tonight's talk. And with that, good night, everyone. Enjoy the upcoming holidays, and we look forward to seeing you next month at the Institute. And thank you very much to Alan and Andrew once again, and making this, as Russell mentioned, an international affair. We have so many folks from all over the place. And thank you.